hundreds of worlds discovered, countless more yet unseen. You're listening to Western Worlds. Hello and welcome back for another conversation here on Western Worlds. My name is Raymond Francis, and I'm coming to you this week, as every week, from the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration at Western University in London, Ontario, Canada. 30 years ago, extrasolar planets were the subject of speculation. None had been discovered, and it was a matter for debate whether they would be common at all. Now, with over 2,000 confirmed detections, they appear to be quite common indeed, and quite diverse. It has become possible to recognize distinct classes of objects, some of which are more easily observed by particular detection techniques. Meanwhile, the growing population of strange new worlds has stimulated efforts to extend those techniques and develop new technologies to search for planets similar to our own Earth. Dr. Sarah Seeger is the Class of 1941 professor at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, working in physics and planetary science. For over 20 years, she has researched the theoretical and observed nature of exoplanets and their atmospheres, as well as the techniques needed to discover and study them. She has, as a result, been involved in several spacecraft missions which include exoplanet studies in their science goals. She is, for example, a co-investigator on NASA's upcoming Transiting Exoplanet Survey satellite mission. Western World's Parshati Patel spoke with Dr. Seeger about the diversity of exoplanets, their potential for hosting life, and upcoming technologies that will allow discoveries of worlds still invisible to our instruments today.
Right, so thank you for talking to us today. We are glad to have you here on our show. Let me just start off by talking about your career, because 20 years ago, we did not have, you know, discoveries of exoplanets. We didn't have them. We did have ideas that, you know, something like our system should exist in space. But now we have 2,000 or more exoplanets that are confirmed. So how did you get into this field of exoplanets?
When I was a graduate student, exoplanets around sun-like stars were just being discovered. And so when I was looking around for a PhD project after I was finishing up a master's equivalent, my advisor actually suggested that I work on the atmospheres of the so-called hot Jupiters. It's quite a risky project, and most people do not give their students projects on objects that a lot of people thought weren't even planets at the time.
Okay, yeah, so, you know, you talked about hot Jupiters. So we have found a host of different kinds of exoplanets. So would you mind just elaborate a bit on what kind of planets we have actually found?
Well, we make up names for them just for a lack of better way of organizing. But the so-called hot Jupiters were among the first planets found around other stars because they're easy to find. And hot Jupiters are Jupiter mass or Jupiter size planets orbiting their star in a few day period orbits. And these planets are 10 times closer to their star than Earth, than Mercury is to the Sun. And they're very hot. They're heated to temperatures of thousands of degrees. We have another type of planet. We call them sub-Neptunes. And these are planets that are 2 to 3 times the size of Earth. Neptune is about 4 times Earth's radius. And so these planets actually have no solar system counterparts. Yet they're extremely common. They may be the most common type of planet in our galaxy, as much as 10 times more common than a Jupiter-sized planet. We have planets we like to call super-Earths, and those would be planets that are predominantly rocky. For a number of planets, we have a mass measurement and a size measurement. And you know, with mass and volume, we get average density. And we're able to tell that some planets, even ones that are a little bigger than Earth, are actually predominantly rocky. So we have the super-Earths. The other ones we have are a subset. We call them hot super-Earths. There have been planets found in less than 1 day period orbits. And these planets may be heated so much on one, they're tidally locked, that is, they show the same face to the star at all times, just like the moon does to Earth. It's just a favorable energy state that's reached relatively quickly in terms of a planet's lifetime. And so tidally locked, if one side is getting heated by the star and that planet is so close to the star, it may be hot enough on the surface to melt rock, thus having liquid lava lakes. There's some other planets people postulate on that may or may not exist called carbon planets in our own solar system. If you have more oxygen than carbon, which is what we have, then oxygen goes with silicon and you get rocks that we're familiar with. But if there was a planet, if there was a disk, and you know, at least one debris disk has been measured to be this way, that carbon is more dominant over oxygen, we also see it in the envelopes of giant stars, then silicon will go with carbon, you get silicon carbide. And all of a sudden you get locked away in the planet. Because remember, carbon and oxygen are both locked in gases usually, but if they get locked in a solid, all of a sudden your planet starts forming with carbon-related compounds. There's one more type of planet I should mention, and there are some planets that are very massive and very young, almost as massive as the planet could be before we think it starts fusing deuterium or something in the deuterium on the inside. And these planets are very far from the star, 100 or even out to 1,000 astronomical units. And we're scratching our heads about how planets could form and be so massive that far from the star. And out of all those things I listed, there's probably everything in between.
So you mentioned about Earths and super Earths. So I guess when people think about trying to find life, automatically you think about Earths and super Earths. So in terms of looking for life, would you look for Earths and super Earths in terms of techniques that can be used to find them?
Yes, in terms of life, we're fixated on the predominantly rocky planets with thin atmospheres. You know, the atmosphere acts like a greenhouse. If the planet has what we call an envelope, a very extensive layer of gas, then the surface is too hot for life. Indeed, some planets, like Jupiter and like Neptune, they have no surface as we know it. And so we're focused on predominantly rocky planets. And we want them to be at a distance from the star because these planets are heated by the star from the outside, where they're not too hot, but not too cold, but just right for life. So yes, we're focused on super Earths or Earths in the habitable zones of their stars.
How... you know, just by sitting here on Earth, would you be able to say, A, this planet has atmosphere, and B, it has the characteristics of hosting life?
The answer is actually we're not. Now, if you read the news, you may think we know, because we have repeatedly heard in the news, we have found another habitable planet. But what they really mean is they know the mass, or the size, or sometimes both, and they know how much energy from the star is hitting the top of the planet atmosphere. That's actually all they know. And the rest is speculation. So we don't know yet. We don't really have the tools yet to look at the atmosphere and assess the greenhouse level of the atmosphere and to even measure a surface temperature. We're not there yet. So right now it's just speculation. I would say that astronomers are just so excited that they have a handful of objects that we can say, you know, might be in their habitable zone.
Given the technology that we have right now, what in the next 10 years or so can we look for in terms of technology to, you know, update the fact that right now we don't understand the atmosphere, but next 10 years, what are we looking for that would help us do?
Well, the good news is that all of the techniques we've been using to find planets and to study their atmospheres is we get a shot at doing that all over again, but with better telescopes, and that can reach smaller planets. So specifically, we have a space telescope. It's been led by MIT. It's a NASA space telescope called TESS, Transiting Extrasolar Planet Survey Satellite. And it's actually four kind of telephoto lenses on the same platform, but spread out so they see a large chunk of the sky. And TESS will survey the whole sky looking for transiting super Earths around small stars. And when those are all found, the James Webb Space Telescope will be launched by then. And we will use the James Webb Space Telescope to be able to study their atmospheres. So all the hard work we're doing now on the hot giant planets, we'll repeat all of that with better technology that's actually being built and getting ready to launch right now.
So this will be a different aspect than what we had for Kepler, because Kepler was literally just looking in one part of the sky and concentrating one part of the sky rather than being the whole sky, right?
Right. It's complicated to explain because each mission kind of carves out a different part of parameter space. But Kepler had a goal, essentially a census, to count how many planets of a given kind exist. And to do that, Kepler focused on one part of the sky at all time. It wanted 150,000 stars that it could look at for years in a row. TESS is taking a different approach, and it's doing an all-sky survey. But each field will only be observed for 26 days, not for a year. So we won't be able to find planets that have one-year periods. However, and this is a little complicated, but small stars, which have a habitable zone closer to them, by Kepler's law, a smaller semi-major axis corresponds to a shorter period. And so there's a sweet spot with the Earths or super Earths transiting small stars in that their habitable zone is close to the star. And in some cases, some parts of the sky will be looked at for more than 26 days. And so TESS will be looking for planets in the habitable zones of small stars.
So you talked about how Kepler was actually just used for the census. So do we have an idea of what kind of planets do we expect? Just majority are Earth size or majority are going to be Jupiter size? What should we expect?
Well, the funny thing is that a lot of time and effort has been gone into saying what will we expect, because when we propose a mission, you know, we're judged based on what yield we expect. But in reality, it'll probably turn out to be quite different. So, you know, literally, TESS is going to expect to find thousands and thousands of planets of all kinds, and we'll probably find hundreds of super-Earths, and we're going to try to narrow that down to 50. That's 50, you know, super-Earths where we have a mass measurement by follow-up observations, and that maybe a small handful of those will be in their star's habitable zones. So out of the things that you're really interested in, we may have a dozen or less, actually, but we'll have something.
Okay. So do we have a good enough model for these planets to, you know, model the atmospheres for, or model their formation for? Because looking at what we have right now from Kepler, we expect different kinds of systems, yet so similar in terms of formation, if you want to have one theory for formation of planets.
Well, we can divide it into planet formation and planet atmospheres. Planet formation is very complicated. Like a lot of models, you can say, in terms of physics, what you put in is what you get out. So if you're unaware of a given process, then you don't have that process in and you're unable to make an explanation. I'd say the good news for planet formation, which I think you're alluding to, is there's more and more data to constrain the theory. Because in the past, planet formation theories would make a prediction. And one time they said, you know, there'll be no super-Earths close to the star. And lo and behold, we find a lot of those. So I think planet formation theory is very challenging, but hopefully they'll figure out what's going on. Now, in terms of the yield for TESS, the so-called planet yield, is Kepler actually looked at a lot of M-stars. And so from that, we still have a good handle on what we might find. Regarding planet atmospheres, the nice thing is that we have decades of work that's been done on solar system planets, and we've been building on that continuously. So the way I feel about exoplanet atmospheres is we've had a test already. We've worked on the hot Jupiters for a decade before we had good data. Now we have a fair amount of data on those, and we've seen we were right in some things and wrong in other things. But essentially, we had the framework built to then, you know, tweak and go in a slightly different direction. And it will be the same for super-Earths, hopefully. And those are more complex because, as you know, for Earth, our atmosphere has evolved over the, you know, the history of the planet. And the small planets have photochemistry and other things dominate as compared to a giant planet, which typically retain all the gases they were born with. And so there's more complicated things going on in the atmosphere. But again, we're spending a decade making models and doing things and trying to make predictions. But ultimately, I believe we'll have a solid framework in place. When we get the data, we'll be able to make headway.
Okay. Now, when you talked about looking for life on just planets. Now, you know, here in our solar system, we do have some places that we are interested in looking for life. For example, Europa or, you know, Titan. Would in next, let's say, 20 to 25 years expect data on moons of planets, exoplanets, where you would expect such atmosphere? Would it be feasible in the next 25 years, I would say?
One thing is we do expect moons with atmospheres to exist orbiting exoplanets, but it's so hard for us to even find and study the exoplanets themselves that we're not focusing on the moons at all right now, and it would probably be so challenging. Imagine that we can barely see an Earth in the future. We can't see one now, and that moon is so much smaller than Earth itself. So we're not, even though moons surely exist and would be great places, unless they're Earth-sized themselves, we're probably not going to be able to handle them.
Would new techniques be helpful in terms of trying to find life on such planets rather than the old techniques where we use the radial velocity method?
Yes, and in fact, out of all the planet techniques out there, only two of them typically lead to planets whose atmospheres we can study. One is the transit technique, because the planet can go in front of the star and we can see the starlight shine through the planet atmosphere. The other one is so-called direct imaging, where we get rid of the starlight and see the planet directly. So those two techniques enable us to study exoplanet atmospheres, and they're both being worked on. Transits are very popular now. It's our most favorable planet-finding technique right now, and direct imaging is being worked on also.
Mm-hmm. So, using the transit method, which I guess is very popular, as you said, by Kepler, how does one come up with understanding the atmosphere of planet just by looking at the spectra from the star?
Well, with the transiting planet, we can't see the planet and star separated on the sky, so we look at it in the combined light of the system, whereby when the planet, we can take a spectrum of the star by itself, and then we can take a spectrum of when the planet goes in front of the star. And we can compare those two, and the difference will actually be the planet spectrum. And there's a lot of work behind that statement, but that's essentially how we get spectra. Also, when a planet goes behind the star, we can see the combined light drop by a tiny amount. And then we will see it when the planet reappears from going behind the star, the light rises again. And by measuring that drop in brightness, we can actually extract the, we call it the brightness temperature, but you can just say the temperature of the planet. And if we can do that at different wavelengths, we can get an emission spectrum.
Now that we have so much handle on, you know, the statistics that we have for Earth-like planets, Jupiter-like planets, Neptune-like planets, what next step do you think in terms of technology and also in terms of trying to find the life that is more just than a microbial life? What is the next step in terms of technology are we looking at to trying to find that kind of life?
Okay, well, there's a lot of questions there, but let's just say that what we want to do now, out of all the planets we know about, we really need to push down to smaller and smaller planets around stars like the Sun. And that will take a whole new technology. And what we're hoping to do is direct imaging from space. We have many different ways we think we can do it, three different ways. And two of them are being studied right now. And that is, we need to block out the star with a specially shaped, either a big occulting screen far from the telescope or a special shape inside the telescope, a coronagraph, to block out the light. And we hope to be able to find the planets directly. And as far as the whole search for life goes, we're trying to take one step at a time. You know, first we ask, do other Earths exist and are they common? And that's what we're answering right now. They're common. We know small planets are common. Now we want to know whether they're like Earth. And we'll do that by direct imaging and being able to see the planet atmosphere and characterize the planet. We hope to see signs of life by way of gases that don't belong in the atmosphere that could be attributed to life. And in that sense, we'll hopefully know whether microbial life exists and maybe even is common. And with all of that, one could then speculate on whether intelligent life may be out there. And I think the whole search for extraterrestrial intelligence is starting to funnel into focusing on planets that we have discovered. So they have real targets now to focus on.
So you talked about looking for special gases in terms of the atmospheres of these planets. What are those gases? Are we looking at the same kind of gases we find here on Earth?
Well, it's such a great question. And the answer is we're working on it. Lots of people are trying to understand this. On our own Earth, would you believe there's so many gases, we couldn't barely even count all the ones produced by life. Many of them are just not produced in great quantities. Like when you walk through a pine forest, all those smells, that's all gases being produced by life, by those trees. So it turns out that to start with, we just focus on the gases produced by life on Earth that are major gases or very spectroscopically active. And those are like oxygen. Our Earth has 20% oxygen by volume. But without plants and photosynthetic bacteria, we would have almost no oxygen, certainly not detectable from a remote space telescope. We have ozone, a photochemical byproduct of oxygen. We have N2O, nitrous oxide, methane. But we get into a lot of gases that, although they're produced by life, hydrogen sulfide and methane are two good examples, they're also produced by volcanoes or deep sea vents. And, you know, nature has the same molecules to work with that life does. So in the chemical reactions, you could look at our atmosphere and say which of the gases in our atmosphere are produced by life. And believe it or not, out of all the gases that are in our atmosphere that are just there for reasons like nitrogen or like carbon dioxide, those are also produced by life, but they're also kind of there already. So the search for biosignatures is complicated by that point. Now, there's a whole host of gases that are only produced by life and that are hard to be naturally occurring in large quantities. And these are ones that you may not have heard of, like methyl chloride, or dimethyl sulfide. The astrobiologists and exoplanets went big on dimethyl sulfide. It's produced by plankton in the ocean, and we don't really know why. It's like a stress hormone or something. And they feel that, and that fills the atmosphere. And for a while, atmospheric scientists thought that it ended up forming particles that clouds nucleated on. And so for a while, it had this role in like global warming science, because when clouds form, they can cool. And so there's a whole number of gases. We try to enumerate all of them. But the bottom line, I personally believe now, after working a lot in this field, is that any small molecule could be produced by life, really. We just don't know a priori. And so we want to be able to look at a broad wavelength range with enough spectral resolution so we're prepared to identify a gas that is really there many orders out of equilibrium than it should be.
We are running out of time, but it was great talking to you about this new exciting topic. And hopefully in years to come, you're going to hopefully find life in, you know, in an exoplanet that's just like Earth. But thank you for talking to us today.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Western Worlds. Let's go to the discussion.
So we just listened to my interview with Dr. Sarah Seeger. Very interesting topic. Actually, this is my favorite topic. Exoplanets. They're very interesting.
Yes.
It was, yes.
Can you believe, like, 20, 25 years ago, like, you know, if you would have said word exoplanet, you'd be like, what?
Yeah, no, exactly. it's a very, very, it's one of the most, the newest and the most exciting fields in astronomy, and I suppose planetary science, I suppose we get to say planetary science.
It's definitely a hot topic. I like the way she didn't over-exaggerate it. She was realistic about, for example, the habitable worlds and the false or ideas that people sometimes have, thinking that we've actually discovered habitable worlds rather than planets that could possibly have habitable.
I really appreciated the way she cleared that up, because what she said in the interview about when they discover a new planet, that it's an Earth-like planet in the habitable zone, isn't actually necessarily the case. It was good to get some realism, some grounded sort of evaluation of the data that's produced. That's very important. I found that her giving a more precise indication of what that data was, actually, it didn't take away from the excitement at all. You know what they're actually talking about. That was a nice part of that interview.
Yeah, I think it was. I've seen over the years, like, you know, when they discover a new planet and, you know, it comes out in media completely different than when you read the paper. Because when you read the paper, they say, okay, there should be, given all what we know, pressurized carbon, you know, that we should expect. Given the models that we have, we did not go there with, you know, our instruments and measured it. Mm-hmm. But we are doing it from a distance. And then media comes out, we found a diamond planet, yay!
Yeah, that's exactly right.
That's not the same thing. But I guess that's how, you know, masses would see it when you say pressurized carbon. The way we know it here is
just
diamond.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? So, but it's really interesting to see. It's just the models would give you an idea of what the atmosphere of that planet
would
be.
Exactly, yeah.
What the surface, if it had any, would look like. Just by, like, doing the modeling and using whatever suite of techniques that we have currently. I think that's very, very interesting given, you know, they've only been found 20 years ago.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
Starting 20 years ago.
Exactly right. And what you were saying about the planetary atmosphere stuff, being able to derive from the spectrum information from transiting planets, what's in their atmospheres, that's also very interesting. That's very intriguing science. I'm very interested in those concepts. Finding those concepts and seeing how much detailed information you can actually get from something like that, because of course you're working with, in the scale of volumes of data, you're working with tiny amounts of data, and yet even now you can get really detailed information, which is very interesting. So
I think the technique of spectral analysis is very, very common, you know, for people who are in astronomy, right? So applying that to a planet, trying to figure out what it's made of, you know, in terms of atmosphere, it's really cool. And I think light is your god, basically giving you all the data that you need for our far, far away. So we are pretty good at doing spectral synthesis. We're pretty good at predicting things using models. So I am looking forward to the day when we are looking at the moons of those. You know,
you mentioned this in the interview, and that was very, yeah, I mean, obviously.
It's far-fetched, but hello, there are movies made about it.
Well, you say far-fetched, but like you said, 20 years ago, if somebody had said, oh, I wonder what planet's around that star, people would have shouted that, so maybe not so far-fetched.
Yeah, that's why I said, when I said, like, you know, in next 25 years, do you think that's possible? Because in the last 25 years, we've come a long way.
Yeah. I found she was very practical,
mm-hmm.
saying, well, someday, surely,
yeah.
and perhaps if it was an Earth-sized moon, but we're struggling to get Earth-sized planets.
Mm-hmm.
And when we really see, what do we know? We know mass,
mm-hmm.
we know density, we know the distance mm-hmm. to the star in many cases. So we can work out, as she pointed out, we can work out the energy which the planet is receiving. And in some cases, we have an idea of the atmosphere. But I've heard it likened to picking up a firefly next to a spotlight or something. It's so many orders of magnitude smaller than the signal we're picking up from the star that it's going to be difficult. And we're only going to get the major components of the atmosphere. And to pick up these biomarkers, mm-hmm. these odd molecules, these gases that she was commenting on that are only produced by life
mm-hmm.
and not from vents and volcanoes yeah. and things like that. That's a tall order.
I was a little bit... I thought that she actually made a good point that there are some of these molecules that are produced, they're produced by life, but they're also produced by other processes. And I think that's quite interesting as well, because I think that in certain circumstances, you could find a planetary body which has these special molecules in it, but it doesn't necessarily mean there's life.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know from another interview on Western Worlds, interviewing on Western Worlds, that it's more to do with the interaction between certain families of these molecules and how their replenishment rate is related to their population. And it's actually looking at that interaction that tells you whether it's being biologically produced or not.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, yeah, that's just very interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, we know that things like amino acids, we have found those in, you know, star-forming regions, places where all this material that planets come from, actually, we can see them. So, given that they are not as rare as we think, I think the idea to try to find life, given the same kind of structure as we have here, life here on Earth, is not far-fetched, but we have a lot of technical difficulties to get over before, you know, we can actually use any of the data to even say that there is life here. You know, we might have those elements or we might have those gases, but you never know what other kind of reaction that we don't get here in the solar system could produce those. So, unless you get there, you never know.
I think another good point that she made was how difficult it is for people who are modeling planet formation. It was hard enough when you have to come up with a scenario that's going to create both the terrestrial and the gas giants. And there's all kinds of ideas about migration and the time schedule for making them. But now we have hot Jupiters. How do they get there?
Mm-hmm.
How do they survive?
Yeah.
With the energy that they're receiving, how do they maintain, unless they're very, very young,
mm-hmm.
and they just don't survive? But we apparently there's quite a number of them. So the diversity of planets, that was a big point, the strong point that she made.
Yeah.
So many different types.
And even the class of planets, I can't remember quite what she called them, Neptunes.
Neptune-sized planets.
Yeah, small Neptunes, about four times the radius of the Earth. And she was saying that actually they could be the most numerous planets in this galaxy. The most numerous type of planets in
yeah.
the galaxy, the amount that they're finding.
Yeah.
It would be interesting to know what drives those numbers.
Mm-hmm.
What drives the numbers that leads to so many Jupiter-sized planets being closer to their star than Mercury? What drives the numbers that leads to the large volumes of Neptune-sized planets? And what drives the numbers of rocky planets that we're finding? Obviously, at the moment, it's also a function of the fact that they're so small and difficult to detect. It would be interesting to know what really goes into them, because of course, especially with the Neptune type planet she mentioned, she actually said that there's no analog in our solar system for that kind of planet. So
mm-hmm.
we're then back to the point that some people were making before the emergence of the exoplanets field, that our solar system would be a very, very unique construct and not like what is found commonly in the galaxy.
I think we are finding, you know, systems that have 4, 5, 6 planets.
Yes, absolutely.
Right? So I think in a couple of decades, we should be able to understand, you know, the formation of our solar system and planet formation in general by studying the interactions of these planets with each other and comparing it to solar system, which is way more stable than a lot of these systems that we are finding. And I think that's what we should be looking forward to, is getting the whole scenario using these candidates or exoplanets that we already have as the bait.
It's still a challenge to detect terrestrial type planets, the Earth size or smaller. And so we will have strong selection effect. We are finding the large planets, and that's what we would expect.
Yeah.
What's happening? What's happening with these smaller planets, the terrestrial type planets closer in? I think we'll sort of find that out.
Yeah.
That's our show for this week. Western Worlds is a production of the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration at Western University. Western Worlds was created by John Moores. This episode was produced by Parshati Patel, who also conducted the interview. Our roundtable discussion featured co-hosts Parshati Patel, Tony Martinez, and John Kissy. Our editors were John Kissy and Parshati Patel, and I'm Raymond Francis. Our theme music is Heliosheath by Sean Kim. You can continue the conversation online and listen to past episodes, or learn more about Western Worlds, by visiting our website at cpsx.uwo.ca/westernworlds. You can also email us at westernworlds@uwo.ca. On Twitter, we are at WWCPSX, and on Facebook, we are facebook.com/westernworlds. On behalf of everyone here, I'd like to thank you for joining us tonight. I hope you can find world enough and time to join us again right here on Western Worlds. Thank you.